I'm into something here that I cannot understand.
We are in the middle of a war, one that's been going on forever.
With tech, the secret's so powerful that if revealed, it would devastate the very foundations of mankind.
What are you talking about?
You asked what would be worth killing for. Witness the biggest cover-up in human history.
Well, that's what they're saying about the Da Vinci Code, the biggest cover-up in human history. Some people believe it. Some people are not taking it seriously. The film is coming out later this week. We're going to be talking about Da Vinci Code as a conspiracy theory for the next half hour of Issues, Etc. Paul Coughlin is our guest. Then we've got audio open lines for the remainder of the program. Paul Coughlin is a host of a radio talk show in Southern Oregon. He is author of the book Secrets, Plots, and Hidden Agendas, What You Don't Know About Conspiracy Theories, and another called No More Christian Nice Guy. Paul, welcome back. Oh, we don't have Paul yet. We'll get Paul here in just a moment. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. And our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. We are going to be talking about a number of things coming up in about a half hour. The Da Vinci Code will be a big part of it. The film is coming out, and already the critics are not terribly enthusiastic about The Da Vinci Code as a film. And then, of course, there are all sorts of elements that are brought out in the plot of The Da Vinci Code that we'll be dealing with. We've got a piece from PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly dealing with some of the secret societies and other things that are brought up by The Da Vinci Code, Dan Brown's novel, and the film that's coming up here in about a half hour. Audio open lines. Paul Coughlin is a regular guest. Paul, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Glad to be with you, Todd. Thank you.
What makes conspiracy theories? Why do we love them so much? Why do we find them so fascinating?
Well, there's many answers to it. At the top of it would be that they appeal to our pride, right? There's nothing like being on the inside track, having exclusive information, exclusive knowledge of the happenings of the world. This is it's been a temptation since the Tower of Babel. And it'll always be a temptation. In regard to religious circles, it's really appealing to a certain kind of person who may want to know about God or cosmic things, but may not want to be known by God. It's a great way, to some degree, to remain hidden from God. Because, again, an understanding of Him all remains intellectual. It doesn't get down into the core of your being that you are a horrible sinner in need of God's grace, and that grace is awesome, unlike anything you've ever experienced.
So does this explain this fascination with the secret, our pride, whatnot? Does this explain the popularity of the Da Vinci Code?
Well, yeah, that would be a bit different. I think, you know, there's a sexiness, I guess, to it when you can take something sacred and supposedly carve into what some people would say is a sacred cow, and to take this large institution that for thousands of years has been awfully powerful and, in a sense, kind of throw sand in its face. That would be attractive to a certain kind of person. Likewise, but there are Christians who feel the same way toward society. Many of the conspiracy theories that Christians adhere to are a throwing sand in the eyes of a culture that has not treated it with respect.
So should seeing the conspiracy theory that stands at the heart of something like the Da Vinci Code give Christians who recognize that one, should it give them pause about accepting other kinds of conspiracy theories that they are so quick to buy into?
Oh, Todd, I sure hope so. I tell you, and I've been thinking about this, you know, ever since the movie in particular is coming out, you know. I've thought, I sure hope that evangelical Christians do not go after the Da Vinci Code because it's a conspiracy theory. Because if they go on those grounds, it'll be one of the most hypocritical acts they will ever commit. Evangelical Christianity is replete with conspiracy theories, particularly, as you know, about this so-called New World Order. So I hope that it causes pause and have them rethink it. But, you know, Todd, I had the same hope with Y2K, that after our overreaction, our hyperextension, our hyperventilization of Y2K and how we made the gospel look so silly, that we would rethink some of our larger claims about these global conspiracy theories And I have to say, I saw nothing that would support my hope.
Pardon the pun, but do you think that conspiracy theory Christians will connect the dots when they reject the conspiracy theory that is the Da Vinci Code, and yet go home and say, all right, now where's that book I had on the Priory of Zion? They got it all wrong. I know what it's really all about.
I sure hope. You know what? Sure, there will be a few. But I don't, Todd, I don't mean to be pessimistic, but it's not going to be widespread unless it is shown. No, even if it's shown with great clarity and care and it is broadcast on billboards and, you know, Fox News all the time, or, you know, wherever it's widely seen. There's something about these conspiracy theories that are so ingrained, particularly within the popular and contemporary Christian mind, that it's going to take more than that, almost like a kind of exorcism, I suppose.
Let's go through kind of this in an anatomical way, if we could, Paul, and give us, in broad strokes, the anatomy of a classic conspiracy theory, what its elements are, and then if you could apply that model insofar as it fits to the Da Vinci Code.
Well, these we're talking about grand conspiracy theories as opposed to smaller, more legitimate, I can prove it in court conspiracy theories with evidence. Because, of course, conspiracies exist, and we've been dealing with them for forever, and sometimes they can be proven and sometimes they can't. But we're talking about these overarching conspiracy theories where large groups, powerful organizations or individuals come together to essentially control the world. And many of these revolve around military, they revolve around international banking, international commerce, international media. In regard to the Da Vinci Code, they would argue that it is a international religious movements that have deliberately squelched further spiritual revelation about the nature of God, particularly found in the life of Jesus and those around him. The Da Vinci Code and what it represents talks about many things. One of them is, the Gnosticism, where they would deny that Jesus appeared in the flesh. And I tell you what a cruel, cruel belief to unleash upon humanity. Here it is, God becoming a man, becoming one of us, relatable to us, walking in our shoes, literally walking in our shoes, showing such amazing grace to us to do that for us and to be with us the way that he was. And they want to deny us of that beauty and that wonder and that great gift. Why is the secular media attacking that? It's one of the greatest gifts we could ever receive. In fact, it is the greatest gift we could receive. And here they are. Here's this group trying to take it from us. And when we push back and we talk about there's no proof of such things and that it goes against, you know, the gospels that have been handed down to us through eyewitnesses, we're the ones who get the criticism, not the people who come out and say these things. It's incredible.
Part of any conspiracy theory, the grand ones, is usually some sort of all-knowing, all-powerful agency. In many conspiracy theories, it's government, or it's the UN, or it's some other clandestine organization, association that no one sees the web that it is, but there it is. What is it in the Da Vinci Code? What is that all-powerful, omnipresent, and omniscient agency?
Well, I guess it would be the church in its various states where, again, that it has decided that, you know, it has these competing additional revelations about God and about the life of Jesus, supposedly his marriage and his bloodline and the children that he supposedly sired. And as a result, they want to keep all that kind of hush-hush. And though that sounds great and wonderful and fanciful, I guess to some minds, I tell you, what we currently have is so awesome and so amazing, I just don't understand why they would think that they would need to move into a whole other direction. And the Da Vinci Code, you know, you have this group of people who argued that, you know, all physical things are evil. Again, what cruelty. Not only do they rob us of our Savior, they rob us of the physical pleasures of life, these wonderful gifts of God, great sexual intimacy. The argument really robs us of our humanity. And I just don't understand why that's not being addressed more, particularly in the popular media.
Paul Coughlin is our guest. We're talking about conspiracy theories and the Da Vinci Code. Paul is host of a radio program in Southern Oregon, and he is author of the book Secret Plots and Hidden Agendas, What You Don't Know About Conspiracy Theories, and No More Christian Nice Guy. Feel free to join our conversation, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Paul, this email comes from Eric in Irving, Texas, and he writes, I've been thinking about the conspiracy theory aspects of the Da Vinci Code as it relates to the conspiracy theories of Muslims and Baptists. He says all three conspiracy theories seem to have some basic elements in common. One, apostasy from the original intent of Christ and or the apostles. Two, apostasy solidified or consolidated under Emperor Constantine. And three, true believers persecuted by a church invested with civil authority. Now, he says, taken by themselves, these three elements may have some plausibility. The church has strayed from the true doctrine at times. The church did experience dramatic changes following the legitimacy it received from the Roman state under Constantine. The church did sometimes abuse civil authority when it held civil authority. My question for you would be, do you think that a Christian's ability to counter the arguments of Muslims or Dan Brown is somehow affected or hindered by the widespread embrace of the Baptistic conspiracy theory?
Well, of course, we look like hypocrites. Again, we have promoted a number of conspiracy theories in popular contemporary evangelical Christianity, which, I make that distinction because not everyone obviously believes in the conspiracy theories that are probably best represented in the series of the Left Behind series, one of the best-selling novel series in history of publishing. It revolves around a huge conspiracy theory that we know that Tim LaHaye believes to be true. He would argue that only the names have changed, but the basic plot line is absolutely the case. So, yeah, we hinder our credibility. It's almost like we've helped prepare the ground, the mindset of believing in conspiracy theories, and now here is a grand poobah of conspiracy theories. Unfortunately, it's against the Orthodox faith, and it's like we've made our own bed in regard to this thing.
Now, that's kind of the irony that you could walk into an average kind of evangelical church and find a Bible class in the morning teaching, in essence, the Left Behind series and its core conspiracy. And
yeah.
Then in the evening, a Bible class debunking the Da Vinci Code.
Yes, that's why I hope they don't go after it based on the fact it's a conspiracy theory, because, boy, we will be speaking out of both sides of our mouths. You know, be careful what we do. I hate to say it, Todd. My cynicism in regard to the things that we've done in church just seems to grow with age. It just seems that when it comes to end times conspiracy theories, you can say almost anything, and as long as it's said with charisma, you can get away with it. And you would think that people who have made false predictions about the return of Jesus and who supposedly is the coming Antichrist, and you would think that when they make these statements and they prove not to be true, that it would hurt their credibility and it would hurt their audience. It has been my experience that it actually enhances their audience. It actually galvanizes them. It makes them bigger. It gives them larger publishing contracts, and they get on more radio stations. I don't understand why.
One other thing that I find that some Christian conspiracies have in common with the Da Vinci Code is kind of a root anti-Catholic bias or a prejudice against Catholicism, the institutional church, or something like that. You might ask the average Christian, well, do you think the Da Vinci Code is true? They'd say no, but I do believe that something's fishy over there at the Vatican.
Yeah.
I think they're hiding something from us, or they've been working a long time to kind of control world politics or something along those lines.
Sure, absolutely true. And if you look at some of the more popular, evangelical or rather Protestant conspiracy theorists, there will be an element of what the anti-papal angle in their writing. you know, when you have a large organization that, you know, doesn't exactly have all of its inner workings open to the outside culture, and then also a organization that rubs against culture in general, they're going to receive an amazing amount of criticism. And with that amazing amount of criticism, you know, does form its critics, and its critics will, you know, likely stop at nothing to say even most outlandish things about them. And unfortunately, that it just includes raw misrepresentations of what organizations do. But again, Todd, I've noticed that if it is said with enough charisma, and if it hits enough what I would call pain points, if it touches upon someone's fears, plays upon their fears enough, you know, that's all that's needed to be done for an idea to be popular and in its popularity to be accepted, regardless of whether there's any truth to it.
In general, do you think that baby boomers, which includes, of course, a lot of people, including myself, maybe you too, do you think that baby boomers are more prone to believe a conspiracy theory than previous generations?
Well, there is some of an anti-government flavor, right, of the baby boomer. They don't really trust authority as much as conceivably past generations. I think there's truth to that, particularly when compared with the GI generation. They tended to be a little more accepting. Then with Watergate and Nixon, that was a tough time. And, of course, Vietnam, that's a tough time as well. So these are fundamental parts of a baby boomer's upbringing when they start coming into their own. So I do think there's some truth to that, and maybe Dan Brown, being the smart marketeer that he is able to play into that in a way that maybe he just foresaw it and realized that there'd be more open to it. We have an increasing skepticism toward government, no doubt. It is more partisan than I ever remember it being, and it seems to be. Maybe it's cyclical. I'm not a historian, but it seems to have gotten worse, at least within my lifetime. And maybe it won't always be this way, but I think that's true. I think it's true that the boomers are more prone toward conspiracy theories. You know, particularly, too, with the power of the evangelical pen, again, with the Left Behind series. I mean, that really, really tapped into something that I think a number of people did not think was there. Well, I don't think Tim LaHaye knew was there. I think he sued his original publisher over that, seeing how big the series would be or was becoming. I'm not familiar with the exact parts of the contract, but I think they didn't realize exactly what they had on their hands at the time.
What are some steps that we can take by way of critical thinking or evaluation or how we approach these things that can help prevent us from buying into or falling prey to conspiracy theories like the ones found in the Da Vinci Code or in popular Christian conspiracy theories?
Jesus, try to remember Waco. Try to remember Ruby Ridge. You would not have had David Koresh or Randy Weaver or, for that matter, Tim McVeigh if we hadn't had conspiracy theories. Conspiracy theories have the ability to destroy a person's life. They will send you down a rabbit hole that may seem all exciting and wonderful and neat, but boy, there is nothing but it's dust and destruction. They have the ability to consume a person's mind. And what's wild sometimes, Todd, is actually in some ways some very bright people get caught up in these things. In some ways these people are not bright at all, but in some ways they are. Has the ability to consume their life and to absolutely ruin their life. These conspiracy theories have the ability to take you away from the Orthodox faith and pull you into a kind of para-religion where, you know, Christianity, for example, only becomes relevant in as much as it helps you figure out the coming New World Order or what other secret group is going to be doing so you can somehow prepare yourself for, what you think is about to happen. And when these things don't have, when I wrote the book in 99, I got many letters from the children of conspiracy theorists asking me, how can I reach, it's usually a man, how can I reach my father? He has just gone overboard and he's unrelatable, and he's doing stuff that is crazy. How do I reach him? Unfortunately, it's kind of like they belong to a cult. The further they get into conspiracy theories, the harder they are to reach.
Before we let you go here, Paul, your other book, No More Christian Nice Guy, we've talked with you about it before. What's the latest with it?
Well, some really neat stuff is happening. It's becoming, I guess, more and more popular. It's, I'm now a contributing writer on crosswalk.com. And it's leading to not only some other books, but also to possibly a new traveling men's conference that, if it happens, will be unlike any other men's conference, particularly Christian men's conference, you know, because the book is a bit outside the box. It's a little provocative. But what it attempts to do is show the real Jesus, and that Christian men are okay to behave like the real Jesus. I mean, Jesus could be amazingly tender, but he could also be, you know, tough. He could also show a lot of tough love. I argue that Christian men need to be able to do both. Unfortunately, the ideal Christian man right now can only wear hush puppies. He really can't wear combat boots. And in doing so, he really handcuffs himself in life. He does not bring as much glory to God, and he really frustrates his wife and abandons his children. I argue that the ideal, that if we were honest, Jesus, we would say that he was really a bad Christian man. And so I'm trying to, with this book, and it's been actually very effective, is to show a whole other side of Jesus, and in doing so, bring more people to the abundant life that Jesus came to bring them.
Folks, there's a website you can go to, nomorechristianniceguy.com. It's all one word, nomorechristianniceguy.com. And you can find out more about that book, No More Christian Nice Guy by Paul Coughlin. Real quick question from Neil in Wisconsin before we let you go here on Conspiracy Theories. Question for your guest. He writes, why is Constantine always the bad guy, not just with Dan Brown, but with low church Protestants? What's a balanced view? Surely the church didn't all of a sudden become corrupt when Constantine made Christianity the state religion. About less than a minute for that answer.
You know what? I'm no expert. No, you know what I know about Constantine? I think he was, 7 feet tall? That's about all I know about Constantine, so my apologies. He was a big man with a lot of opinions, and of course that would get you in trouble. So that's the best I can do, Todd.
All right. Paul Coughlin is host of the radio program, a radio program in Southern California. He's author of the books Secrets, Plots, and Hidden Agendas, What You Don't Know About Conspiracy Theories, and No More Christian Nice Guy, a website to visit, nomorechristianniceguy.com. NoMoreChristianNiceGuy.com. Paul, thanks for being our guest.
Hey, I'm glad. Anytime, Todd. It's always a joy.
When we come back from this break, we've got audio open lines for the remainder of the program. We're going to keep on the Da Vinci subject. The critics have been seeing the film and have not been particularly impressed, especially those at the big film festivals. We'll be playing a piece on that. PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly has a piece on the Da Vinci Code, going into some more depth, some real good depth, better than you get on most of these news packages on television. Fox News also has a piece on the Gospel of Judas, a Roman Catholic respondent to this Gospel of Judas, and he does a very good job of kind of laying down how we ought to approach these ancient texts that are somewhat newly discovered. We'll also hear a report on abortion pill deaths and abortion healing after this.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Pastor Mark Schaefer, coordinator of continuing education and related events at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the importance of equipping the priesthood of all believers.
It's so important that, you know, the church, we have faithful pastors, but we also have faithful laypersons. The church can't exist without people. And the more that our lay people understand their role and how they fit in the church, it's good for the church's mission. It's good for the church's service. It's good for the worship life of the church, too.
For more information about the spring retreats at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, including one led by Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. John Seleska, visit their website, ctsfw.edu, or call area code 260-452-2204, 260-452-2204.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer.
72% of Americans support embryonic stem cell research, according to a poll by the Coalition for the Advancement of Medical Research. Opponents of the research say the poll is biased and accuse the biotech industry of deceit. Steve Jordahl has the story.
Let's try your one-legged stand. You count.
Okay, one. Two,
Mark Hartwig three, is working through the four, aftermath of Hodgkin's five, disease six, with his physical therapist, seven, Janice.
Eight,
thanks to two nine, stem cell transplants, the cancer is now in remission.
They've reconstituted all my blood cells, red cells, white cells, platelets, which govern clotting.
Hartwig was given adult stem cells, the only kind that's showing results. Coalition president and poll sponsor Sean Tipton is chasing success with embryonic stem cells, and it seems a long way off.
So the most promising are thought to be spinal cord injury, Parkinson's disease, juvenile diabetes.
Stem cell research is controversial because ethicists say the research destroys a life. Andrew Ferguson of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity says that's a fact the survey dodged.
The question that they were asked does not make it clear that the life of the human embryo from whom stem cells are extracted is ended by that process.
The poll coincides with a push in the U.S. Senate to pass legislation that would rescind President Bush's policy limiting the research. Amanda Banks of Focus on the Family Action says the bill will probably pass.
Unfortunately, many in Congress are fooled by the rhetoric on the other side and the claims that somehow embryonic stem cell research is very hopeful.
The president has promised to veto the bill if it gets to his desk. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
The poll also showed 70% favor passage of legislation to expand stem cell research. The measure has bipartisan support. Earlier this month, former First Lady Nancy Reagan sent a letter to Hatch urging passage of the bill. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob.
On the next Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO. Join Paul Clayton and me, Diane Summers. We'll visit with Rebecca Hayes, managing editor at Cook's Illustrated Magazine, on the May issue of the magazine featuring grilled London broil, Moroccan chicken, turtle brownies, and it rates vanilla ice creams as well. It begins at 11:05, Living Jubilee on AM 850 KFUO.
Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month is a Christ-centered, cross-focused version of The Purpose-Driven Life. It's titled A Theology to Live By, The Practical Luther for the Practicing Christian. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or look for the cover of A Theology to Live By on our website, issuesetc.org. A Theology to Live By, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. For the rest of the program, we've got audio open lines and a lot of things to bring to you. We'll be talking about Da Vinci a little bit more. We dealt with the conspiracy theory angle of the Da Vinci Code before the break with Paul Coughlin. And now we're going to deal with the film that's coming out a little bit later this week in terms of, well, what are the critics saying? Everyone's anticipating a real thriller, but you know, MI3 opened up a real thriller and didn't get a lot of, you know, not as much as they thought it would. It's still going to make money. Don't worry about that. So will Da Vinci, but how good of a film is it? And some people probably just sick of this movie already. Talk about media saturation, and we are guilty of this as much as anybody else, but if we want to do audio on Da Vinci, all we got to do is go to any of the outlets, and we could probably play an entire hour of just little 2.5-minute packages on the Da Vinci Code. And all of them kind of say the same thing. And we're trying to bring you something a little bit different here during this hour of audio open lines. But if you're like me, you're already sick of this movie and you haven't even seen it yet. And I love Tom Hanks. I think he's one of the greatest actors and personalities in Hollywood, but kind of sick of Tom Hanks too. And I haven't even seen her on the screen yet. We'll be talking about that, and then we'll also move on to some other subjects like the Gospel of Judas, and there have been abortion pill deaths, and as we speak, there's testimony being made before Congress from one man whose daughter died as a result of taking an abortion pill. And we'll also hear about various approaches to healing after abortion. We're talking about physical healing, but the emotional and psychological healing. There are many pro-choice groups that are now willing to admit that women need healing after an abortion. We'll hear about that. Now, tomorrow is a big day here on Issues Etc. Thursday is always a big day, but We're going to be doing a remote from Village Lutheran Church, not far from here on Clayton Road in Ladue, from 3 to 6, our regular time tomorrow. We'll be having Dr. Lewis Brighton in to talk about Judgment Day. We'll invite a roundtable of local pastors in to talk about the Lord's Supper, and we'll play Soundbite of the Week tomorrow as we broadcast live from Village Lutheran Church in Ladue. Everyone is invited to attend. You can come in anytime you want to and leave anytime you want to. It's at 9237 Clayton Road. Everyone who attends gets an Issues Etc. pen and an Issues Etc. travel mug, 9237 Clayton Road, anytime between 3. Come early, because if you want to talk to us, you want to say hello, shake hands, we'll have the breaks to do that, but we'll be doing radio any other time, and stay as late as you want, as long as Pastor Temple lets you stay in the church. From 3 to 6 tomorrow on Issues Etc., at 9237 Clayton Road, Village Lutheran Church in Ladue. Well, the Da Vinci Code fails to gather positive praise from the critics at Cannes Film Festival. Here's a report from Associated Press.
The Da Vinci Code is getting lukewarm reviews. At Cannes, where it made its world premiere for critics, it drew shrugs of indifference, some jeering, and a few derisive jabs. Keep in mind now that the most famous of all film festivals is home to the world's toughest movie crowds and critics. The year's most anticipated movie is a generally faithful adaptation of Dan Brown's monster bestseller, spinning a murder thriller that stems from a cover-up of secrets about Christianity's roots. While readers worldwide devoured the novel, reaction from Cannes critics ranged from mild endorsement of its potboiler suspense to groans of ridicule over its heavy melodrama. Critics got their first look at The Da Vinci Code a day before its world premiere at Cannes on Wednesday, when it also debuts at theaters in France and some other countries. The film opens worldwide over the following 2 days, including the United States on Friday. Rita Foley, The Associated Press.
I don't know, maybe having Tom Hanks and Ron Howard together again in a film like this, and then the popularity of this book, people's expectations, the thing has sold like nothing else in publishing, raised the expectations for this film so high that the critics, when they see it, are like, well, all right, it was good, but it wasn't great. And, you know, when people get bonded to something like a book, and they get it in their head, what they think that story is, they've played through it in their imagination after reading a book like The Da Vinci Code. Sometimes film does disappoint. We had this with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. People who watched that film said, it just wasn't the same as the way it looked in my head when I was reading the book as a little kid. So that might have something to do with it. We'll wait and see whether it's a good film. You do need to approach it as fiction. It's Open Lines Issues, Etc., audio open lines, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Are you like me, kind of sick of the Da Vinci Code film even before it's come to a theater near you? I will go and see it. Although, I felt like I've kind of seen it already. Sometimes when you see the previews of movies, it really is a disappointing thing for somebody like me, because I love going to see movies. You watch the preview of a movie, and you go, wow, that's got to be great. You go watch the movie and you realize the preview was really the best part, and the rest of it was kind of sewn together, and you enjoyed the preview more than the movie itself? That should never be, but it very often is. When I watch this with my wife, and it's on, how often is the trailer for Da Vinci on nowadays? I am pretty sure that tonight's episode of American Idol will have, if they're smart, they bought airtime, you know, these million-dollar commercials in the last couple episodes of American Idol, almost as much money people pay for Super Bowl commercials. If they're smart, they put the Da Vinci Code commercial in there. You probably see it tonight. And I watch it, and I say to my wife, it looks exciting. Tom Hanks running down a rain-swept road? Guy standing, lying dead in the Louvre? This looks exciting to me. What about you? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. It's audio, open lines, Issues, Etc. And as usual with open lines, anything you want to talk about. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Issuesetc@kfuo.org. Well, this is a highly anticipated film, and the religious controversy surrounding it, of course, is going to probably make for better box office for Dan Brown. Christians range from, what, deeply offended to blasé about something like this? Here's a piece from PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly. Kim Lawton is the reporter, talking about the religious controversy surrounding the Da Vinci Code film.
It has a little bit of everything.
Demons, omens, codes, monks, Da Vinci.
Throw in grisly murder, sex, pagan rituals, and church conspiracies at the highest levels, and you've got the makings of a blockbuster. A blockbuster that has Christian leaders across the spectrum racing to respond.
Seek the real truth. Christianity has nothing to be afraid of from people who thoroughly investigate the truth behind it.
Popular evangelical author Lee Strobel is among those concerned that the Da Vinci Code casts doubts about the Christian faith.
I'm Lee Strobel, and I've come to Paris, France to investigate...
He's released a new DVD discussion guide that he hopes will help set the record straight.
These aren't peripheral issues. I mean, he's cut right to the core of what we believe as Christians.
Dan Brown's controversial novel has sold more than 40 million copies since its release 3 years ago. The story's blending of fact and fiction also set off a firestorm of controversy within the Christian community. Now the Da Vinci Code's arrival on the big screen has ignited a national conversation about church history and Christian doctrine.
The story's central premise is that for centuries, church authorities have covered up evidence that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married and had a child, and that they have descendants living today.
Now, let's pause here. I cannot help but think of a conversation we had here on Issues, etc. Talk about Da Vinci Code and its bearing on Christian history. And our guest observed that perhaps for the first time in their lives, many evangelical Christians will look into Christian history. You know, Christians that go to church Sunday after Sunday wouldn't know the Nicene Creed from their kneecap. We'll suddenly say, well, you know, Dan Brown says that the Council of Nicaea, Constantine, shaped the future of Christianity and started a grand conspiracy. We've got to disprove that. And for the first time in their lives, they might even read the Nicene Creed or study the history that is readily available any place about what the Christians were really, really discussing at the Council of Nicaea in 325. You know what they were really discussing? Not how can we cover up Mary Magdalene. Mary Magdalene didn't come up at the Council of Nicaea. You know what came up? Jesus Christ. And oddly enough, they thought it was important enough, that subject was important enough, and the errors that they were combating, like that Jesus was not fully God, the relationship between Jesus and his Father, they thought those things were important enough to actually put in writing what the truth is. They used to call it confessing the faith. I wonder, in addition to giving evangelicals their first, perhaps their first or second glance at the Nicene Creed in Christian history, I wonder whether or not the Da Vinci Code might encourage a few Christians who say of themselves no creed but the Bible to take a look at that creed and realize that there's basically the Bible's teaching right there in summary form. Pretty useful confession of faith. Didn't go out of style in 325. I don't know. Back to this piece from PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly with Kim Lawton on the religious controversy surrounding the Da Vinci Code.
Harold Attridge is dean of Yale Divinity School.
The notion that Jesus and Mary were an item who had sexual relations and children is not original with Dan Brown. Is it possible that Jesus and Mary or Jesus and someone were married? It's certainly possible. Is there any evidence for it? I don't think so.
There is vigorous debate about whether it would make a theological difference if Jesus had been married.
Certainly would not affect my Christology, my understanding of the significance of Christ, if he had indeed been married. But the evidence simply isn't there for it.
What's Jesus going to do? Say to his son Jacob, hey, Jacob, you know, I'm fully God and fully man. You're like 78% God and 67% man. And your child is going to be 42% God and 28% man. I mean, it raises all kinds of theological problems.
Now, that's Lee Strobel, and that's a fanciful way to respond to the whole contention that Jesus was married and had kids. Of course, Dan Brown will not admit for a second that Jesus was 100% God and 100% man. This is one of the reasons you cannot get into the physiology of the incarnation. You can't, because It's impossible. Now, I was a little struck by what Harold Attridge at Yale University Divinity School had to say when asked if Jesus were married and had kids, wouldn't affect my Christology. I wonder what his Christology is, if it wouldn't affect his Christology. The issue isn't marriage. The issue is having children. What in the world would Jesus be having children for? His purpose in coming into this world was not just to live like one of us, but to live like we couldn't. And to a very specific person, he was born to die, not to settle down, get an apartment with the wife, and raise some kids. It was that very thing that he was not sent to do. Not that those are wrong. His purpose in being sent in human flesh was not to kind of have the human experience. He says, I'm not of this, I didn't come from here, and I'm going back to my Father. And his way back to the Father leads through a cross and a tomb for sinners. In other words, Jesus, the purpose for which he was sent, does not include a house with a white picket fence and 3.2 children. It simply doesn't. So I think it certainly would affect anyone's Christology if their Christology resembles that of Holy Scripture.
The Da Vinci Code also alleges that early Christians viewed Jesus as a mere mortal until the 4th century, when Emperor Constantine pressured the Nicene Church Council to declare Jesus both fully human and fully divine. The story further accuses a male-dominated church hierarchy of suppressing early Christian texts, including some that emphasized female wisdom and sexuality. Both liberal and conservative scholars agree that Brown's portrayals of early church history are full of inaccuracies. But he taps into public fascination with the recent discoveries of ancient documents called the Gnostic Gospels. Some scholars argue these texts should not be summarily dismissed as heresy.
The people who loved and circulated, copied, and wrote down these Gospels did not think they were heretics. They thought of themselves as Christians who had received, in addition to what Jesus taught publicly, they thought they had also received some of the teaching that Jesus taught to disciples when they were alone.
Now, that voice unidentified is Elaine Pagels. We've dealt with Elaine Pagels' teaching here before. Notice her thinking. The Gnostics didn't think of themselves as heretics. They thought of themselves as Christians. Now, Elaine Pagels doesn't think of herself as a heretic. I don't know if she thinks of herself as a Christian or not. Who knows? She's written extensively about the Gnostic Gospels, but just because the Gnostics, the early Christian, quote-unquote Christian Gnostics, didn't think of themselves as heretics, didn't think of their writings that form so much of the basis of things like the Da Vinci Code as heretical, doesn't mean they weren't. Does any heretic say, I'm a heretic? Does any heretic walk around with a card in his wallet saying, card-carrying heretic? No. By definition, heretics believe themselves to be purveyors of the truth. I think it was an ancient church father, Irenaeus, who said the real danger of heresy is that it portrays itself as more true than the truth itself. The heretic believes with all his heart that he is on the side of truth. It's a sad irony of heresy is that while believing with all his heart, sincerely believing that he's on the side of truth, he believes a lie. It's the saddest thing about heresy. So we do not measure heresy. We don't go ask the heretic, are you a heretic? Because none of them will tell you they are. I thought Elaine Pagels was smarter than that, but...
Many Christians are outraged at the suggestion that the traditional Gospels are not definitive.
Certainly the historical evidence for the reliability of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John far exceeds the historic reliability of the so-called Gnostic Gospels, which were written in the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries.
Others say despite its many errors, the Da Vinci Code wasn't wrong on all counts.
Brown has it right up to a point in his narrative about the development of church's attitudes towards women. And also he has it right when it comes to describing the creation of the myth of Mary Magdalene the prostitute, which is a creation of late antiquity. One of the things that people often are rather surprised at is that there's no evidence of Mary being a prostitute in the pages of the New Testament.
Action.
Some of the most sensationalistic aspects of the Da Vinci Code surround its portrayal of the Roman Catholic organization Opus Dei. One of the story's central bad guys is an albino Opus Dei assassin monk, Silas, who kills to protect church secrets. Opus Dei was founded in 1928 by Monsignor, now Saint, José María Escrivá. He preached that lay people had a special calling to live out their faith in their everyday lives. The group has generated criticism for its conservative stance and for what some have called secretive tendencies.
The more I look at Opus Dei as an organization, the more I like it. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't agree with everything that they teach. I don't know everything that they teach, but I suspect strongly them being kind of the most Romanist of the Roman Catholics, I would disagree with them profoundly on certain points. But the more that I look at it as an organization, kind of its founding philosophy, the more I think this is a really good idea. You know, through the Middle Ages, the Roman Catholic Church was more or less controlled by the monasteries. They were the most powerful organizations in the church. And they were far more than just clubs where people went to be especially holy. They were part and parcel of Roman Catholic theology, the error at the heart of medieval Roman Catholic theology. They were really, in a lot of ways, an institutional projection or an institutional expression of what was wrong with Roman Catholic theology. And then comes along an organization like Opus Dei, late in time, of course, that flies in the face of the whole theology behind the monastic orders. That to truly be holy before God, you have to be set apart from society and culture and family and all these things with self-chosen works rather than simply living in your vocation before Christ in faith and before your neighbor in love. Now, that's the classic articulation of the Lutheran doctrine of vocation. We live by faith in Christ and by love in our neighbor. It is the organizing principle of the Christian life. It is the summary of the Christian life in one sentence: living before God by faith, before our neighbor in love. And Opus Dei seems to have that pretty well in its pocket. They seem to understand that one need not enter a monastic order in order to live fully as a Christian. If it weren't called Opus Dei and it didn't have all sorts of secretive aspects to it, you'd almost wonder whether or not they'd been reading from the pages of Luther on vocation. You'd almost wonder. You know, other confessions of faith would do well to take a hint from an organization like Opus Dei when it comes to how it teaches Roman Catholics to live in their ordinary, everyday life in faith toward God and in love toward their neighbor.
But journalist John Allen, who's written a book about Opus Dei, says the image in the Da Vinci Code bears little resemblance to reality.
Well, first of all, Opus Dei doesn't have any monks, so this is an organization for lay people. It's not a monastery. Secondly, so far as anyone is aware, they've never dispatched assassins for any purpose. Then you have the prelate, the bishop in charge of Opus Dei, who has these, you know, huge bags of cash with which he's trying to influence global events. Well, Opus Dei just is not that wealthy. Globally, their assets are about $2.8 billion, which is roughly the same size as the Archdiocese of Chicago.
In the Da Vinci Code, Silas inflicts bloody self-mutilation when he prays. Allen says this is a lurid exaggeration of the ancient Catholic practices of corporal mortification.
I suppose the two best known and most commented upon would be first the psyllus, which is a spiked chain that is worn around the upper thigh for 2 hours every day except on Sunday, and then the discipline, which is a small cloth whip that is administered to the back once a week, usually on Saturday, for the length of time it takes you to recite a prayer. It doesn't cause bleeding, it doesn't whip you into a kind of religious ecstasy and so on. It's really intended to remind you of the physical reality of sin, to remind you of the suffering of Christ on the cross, and to remind you of suffering in the world.
Opus Dei spokeswoman Terry Karen says only about one-third of Opus Dei members actually practice corporal mortification.
A lot of people in the church, holy people who inspired many other people, have done instances of physical penances. I'm kind of puzzled by that we're being defined by this, because in many cultures, in many Catholic cultures, this is no big deal.
That's first of all, they're brilliant to have what's her name again here, Terry Karen, as their spokesperson. That's a brilliant move on the part of Opus Dei, especially with all of the heat they're catching. And as odd as it seems to us, in kind of Protestantized America, that there would be Christians who would say, okay, they're going to wear some sort of a chain around their leg, or they're going to have a little cloth whip when they pray. That does seem extremely odd, and it is very prone, could be prone to abuse. And as weird as it seems to some, it's certainly not what's going on in the Da Vinci Code. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Before we go to this break, let's talk with Jay, who calls from her car. Hi, Jay.
Hello?
Hi.
Hey, you know, I have a couple of points, because I've been following the Da Vinci Code, and I've read the book, love the book and all that, but here's what upsets me most about it. As first of all, by giving so much attention to the movie, we're giving power to it. So everybody and their brother wants to go see the movie now and see what it's about, right? Secondly, where I find it offensive is that I feel like they don't think Christians or non-Christians alike aren't intelligent enough to decipher the facts. I mean, even Ron Howard has come out. It's just a novel. It's a book. And yeah, there's some historical data, but still, give people credit for having a brain and being able to do that, because it feels like that pastors or priests or whoever, when they're writing this movie, they're afraid of losing their flock. And it's just kind of, you know, don't give it that power. In my opinion, it's like what Ron Howard said. It creates conversation. It's something good. But
okay. No, Jay, I understand exactly what you're saying. And the reason we're talking about it is not in order to say, oh, you know, don't look over here. There's the Da Vinci Code. Don't go over there. Hey, you want to go see the movie? See the movie. If you don't, go, don't see it. Boycotting the movie probably draws more attention to it than anything else. And you're right. It does seem to underestimate the intelligence of both the Christian and the non-Christian reader or viewer. But I think someone once famously said that no one ever starved or got any poorer underestimating the intelligence of the American public. Something like that. It's Audio Open Lines. We'll hear the last bit of this PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly on the religious controversy surrounding the Da Vinci Code. When we come back, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We'll also hear some of Fox News on the Gospel of Judas. They have a very articulate a Vatican representative there responding to some of the questions raised by the discovery of the Gospel of Judas. There's also an ABC News report on abortion pill deaths and a little on abortion healing from PBS and Religion Ethics News Weekly right after this.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.